This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. It's Friday afternoon, so it's our Doctor in the House segment. And as always, we've just restarted Doctor in the House last week after, you know, things have started to settle down a little bit. And of course, we've got consultant urologist Dr. George Lee back with us. How are you doing, George?
I'm very good. I had a good Hari Raya break. And then obviously this is our new normal, right?
Yes, it
is. Even though I can't see you in person, you look ever gorgeous like usual over the Zoom.
Thank you very much, George. And you look relaxed as well. I think that's the word.
Looking from home thing, I can get used to it.
Well, you can't work from home. You are a clinician. You are forced to be in a hospital. You are
an essential service. Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about essential service and also how this whole coronavirus thing and the COVID-19 is affecting the healthcare provision. So we have excellent guests who I worked closely with before, and then hopefully you're going to tell us a little bit more about how this is affecting the healthcare in the bigger picture.
Yes, we are talking specifically actually about surgeries. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've been hearing about surgeries being postponed, some even being cancelled for non-COVID patients, not only in Malaysia, across the world as well. And recently there was a study that projected that if services in Malaysian hospitals are disrupted for 12 weeks, we could face a backlog of more than 150,000 surgeries, and that could take up to 11 months to clear. And so, as you said, George, we have excellent guest to help us, to walk us through the findings of this study, and to really, I'd like for the both of you to share what has been happening for you in terms of surgery, and at the end of the day, what's the impact on patients. So we have joining us, and she's managed to log on. There were some tech issues earlier. Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons, Academy of Medicine, Malaysia. How are you, Prof. April?
Hi, I'm doing fine, thanks.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. So I'm just going to jump right into it. You know, we've been hearing about surgeries being postponed and some being cancelled, as I said, not just in Malaysia, but across the globe. So perhaps I can get each of you to share first, how have your own surgeries been affected and how have you been managing these changes? George, perhaps you could share a little bit on your side.
Well, to start off with, I think it's important to define what is elective operation and also why they were cancelled. I think the COVID-19, the whole pandemic, what we worry about is how the COVID-affected patient overwhelmed the whole healthcare system. And therefore, we want to leave enough capacity so that to basically predict for the worst. So therefore, stopping elective operation itself probably was the right move. However, to define what is elective and what's not, that's another issue. Because for somebody who, let's say in my line of work, who cannot pass urine due to enlarged prostate, a catheter has been put in to temporarily solve the problem. Is that elective or not? The other implications, which in my line of work, which affected this whole stopping the elective operation, is that when we consider doing an operation where blood loss is a risk, then you will need to take into account that obviously during this period of pandemic, it's difficult to recruit regular donors to replenish the blood supply and blood transfusion. Therefore, one has to be extremely careful in order to perform the operation when it's absolutely necessary. So therefore, there's a barrage of all these parameters to take into account, and that's how it's affecting my service. I'm really interested to hear how that is affecting University of Malaya and also Professor April's practice.
Yes, because UMMC is a COVID hospital, so it's very different there, isn't it?
Yeah, actually the whole scenario is extremely complex, and I think a little bit of context is important rather than just jumping straight into the cancellations issue. I would have to say that Malaysia as a whole, the healthcare response to this The preparation started very, very early on. As you know, the first reports or the first notices out of China actually came at the end of 2019. That's why it's called COVID-19. And actually, the response in Malaysia started early in January, which you may not be aware of. So it was even before the first case was diagnosed in Malaysia. But obviously, in the early days, the response preparation was targeted more towards sort of medical care rather than surgical care. And although there were some contingency plans started at that time, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on it. Nevertheless, with the number of cases starting to rise and having planned the initial medical response, surgery got on board as well. And so when the MCO was declared on the 18th of March, there were already surgical contingency plans in place. Now, if you look at the earliest guidance regarding surgery, we didn't actually say cancel all elective surgeries. Okay, we actually gave some guidelines. We said you need to take into consideration your hospital's resources. You need to take into account your local COVID epidemiology, you know. And when I say resources, it's not just operating theatres. It's also, you know, ICU facilities. It's blood resources, as George was saying. So you need to take all of this into account when trying to structure your surgical services during this period. And of course, we had, you know, good guidelines from the Ministry of Health. We also had input from our colleagues overseas as well. So it's really a tailored approach, although there is some overarching principles that guide us in crafting this approach. So that's the context. Okay. So in terms of defining what is elective and what is emergency, at the beginning, we referred to the National Perioperative Mortality Review Guidelines, and this was established in 2018. So actually, it was already there. And these guidelines broadly categorize surgeries into elective and emergencies. But obviously, since then, with more evidence emerging, these guidelines have been refined. So the latest guidelines actually subcategorize these even further. So for instance, emergencies, you have the acute emergencies where, you know, you have to do the surgery immediately or the patient's going to die. And, you know, these would include bleeding from trauma, for instance. You've got to stop the bleed. Right. Mm-hmm. But then you have the less acute emergencies where you need to perform the surgery to save the life or the limb within a few hours. So 6 to 8 hours. Right. And then you have those which are urgent, but, you know, perhaps you have a few days to wait or, you know, more than 24 hours. Then you've got the electives. Now, when we say elective, it doesn't mean that the surgery isn't necessary. Mm-hmm. It is just that the acuity is not so great. You can plan the timing of the surgery, and you would not necessarily compromise the patient's outcomes by waiting a certain amount of time. But of course, this is not an indefinite amount of time. So according to the guidelines, there are three categories of elective surgeries. Category one are the cancer operations. Mm-hmm. Okay, so cancer surgeries where you try not to wait more than a month before doing the surgery. Then you have category two where you need to do the surgery within 3 months. And then category three are the ones that you can wait maybe 6 to 12 months mm-hmm. to perform the surgery, and it wouldn't adversely compromise the patient's outcomes. So you can see that, I know there's a lot of discussions on the media about cancers being cancelled, etc. But actually, although they are elective per se, they are in the highest category of electives. Mm-hmm. Okay, so depending on your hospital's resources, you may decide, for instance, if actually you've got enough resources, but maybe the number of COVID admissions, it seems to be rapidly rising. So you don't want to do all elective surgeries. You may choose to prioritize emergencies as well as category one electives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way of looking at it. However, should your hospital's resources start reaching their capacity, their limit, you may say then we'll stop all electives and we'll just do emergencies. Okay, so it's about being able to be responsive to developments. Because obviously we're living this in real time, right? It's not possible for us to absolutely predict what's going to happen. So you need to have policies in place that allow you to scale, you know, either scale up or scale down depending on what the current situation is.
Yeah.
I mean, Prof. April, obviously what you describe is very comprehensive, and then that is all the guideline laid out by the expert, by the surgical societies. How do you think that's affecting University of Malaya medical service currently after 2 to 3 months of MCO?
Yeah, we had a very stressful time in the beginning, I would have to say, because if you remember, sort of at the beginning of March, there was this sudden surge of cases.
Mm.
And our hospital had been identified as what's called the COVID hybrid hospital. So it's a bit different to a full COVID hospital. A full COVID hospital would be somewhere like Sungai Buloh or HKL, where they basically decanted all other services and just focused on looking after COVID patients. Whereas a COVID hybrid hospital is one where, yes, we do care for COVID hospital, but there are non-COVID cases still being performed. And so that creates another level of complexity, because you've somehow got to be able to isolate the COVID cases, mm-hmm, away from the non-COVID cases. And that includes the wards, the operating theatres. It even boils down to maybe cycling your staff so that not everybody is exposed at the same time. That way you're not going to suddenly find yourself completely without staff because they all have to be quarantined. So it was actually quite complex, and we had to come up with workflows and policies. And that's why for a short period of time, we actually put a stop completely. And this was like a complete stop of all elective surgeries. What that meant was that we also had to ensure our elective patients, especially the category one, the cancer patients, were not unfairly compromised, which meant that we had to sort out referrals to other hospitals so that they could get their surgeries, even if we could not provide the surgeries for them.
Mm.
It also meant that we had to suddenly downsize from, you know, a few hundred surgical beds. We had to downsize to something like 24 beds, and this had to happen within days. So, you know, it was a very, very stressful period during that time. Having said that, because we clamped down quite hard and quite early on, it meant that we bought ourselves time to think through what our contingency plans were going to be, our workflows were going to be. We were able to train our staff so that they knew how to appropriately protect themselves when doing surgeries. And that meant that when we actually restarted surgeries, everything went very, very smoothly, you know, and so far, touch wood, we've not had any transmissions to our surgeons from inadvertent exposures.
So I guess then the question is, if there, even with the category one for the elective surgeries, that's a little bit of an echo there. So
I think we're having a bit of a technical issue. I think maybe Xiao-Yi wanted to find out, is like, you know, with the cancer kind of patient, what sort of like impact that will have, because initially it was all shut down because, you know, obviously there's a spectrum of cancer care. Some cancers are recurrent cancers. Some cancers are low-grade cancers. And then it's difficult for patients to understand that as well, right? What sort of support do you think we need to provide patients during this difficult time? On one hand, patients are scared of coming to hospital and maybe contract some sort of diseases. On the other hand, they're also worried that the cancer might just get a bit out of hand.
Sorry. And we will get back to that. We'll just go for a very quick break. So hold on to that thought, Prof. April and George. We'll go for a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about that. You know, the impact on patient. We're talking about patient outcomes as well as their, you know, their psyche as well. So I'm speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, as well as Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons, Academy of Medicine of Malaysia. Here on Health and Living. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. Today is our Doctor in the House segment. And as always, we have consultant urologist Dr. George Lee joining us. And we also have Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons, Academy of Medicine of Malaysia. So before the break, George, you had asked Professor April to talk about the impact of delayed surgery on patients. So I hear really we're talking about when certain elective surgeries, I mean, you've said yourself, elective surgeries doesn't mean that they're not critical surgeries, they're not unimportant. They it's a health condition that is significant for the patient. And any decision to delay that and to reschedule it must weigh heavily on the patient as well as on their families. So how do you have that conversation with your patients?
Yeah, so as with any aspect of healthcare, I think the healthcare providers need to be proactive about managing patient expectations and managing the concerns that they may have. And part of that starts off with all the healthcare providers being aware of why things are being done the way that they're being done. Okay, so what we did very, very early on is I made sure that my department was aware of developments and the rationale for why we were doing certain things and the rationale for why we were having to postpone surgeries. This way, when they're having to call up the patients, they can explain it in a rational and logical manner. So basically, at the core of it is that we need to ensure patient safety. Okay, so surgery is not without risk. So even under normal circumstances, we always counsel patients about the pros and cons of undergoing surgery. Mm-hmm. And essentially, when we recommend surgery, it's because we feel that the benefits outweigh the risks. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you throw in the issue of the pandemic, you've got an additional layer of risk there. Because if the patient is coming into the hospital, even if for instance, they don't have the infection, they may inadvertently come into contact with it in the hospital, for instance, right? And so then what is the risk then to them if, let's say, the surgery is at that point in time not immediately essential? Mm-hmm. Especially if, let's say, the contingencies in that hospital have not been fully set in place. So I'll give you an example. At one point, earlier on in the pandemic, hospital resources, certainly our hospital resources, were getting quite stretched because we were running out of PPE. We were, you know, having issues with ICU or critical care facilities. And it was just for a short period. But, you know, at that point in time, it did not make sense for us to be performing surgeries that were not immediately urgent. Okay, so I think because we took control of it quite early, we didn't run into a situation where we were completely overwhelmed. So you don't find that happening so much in Malaysia as compared to what you saw happening in Italy and in some other parts of the world. So I think it was about controlling that aspect of the care. But you're right, you know, it's not easy for patients to hear when they've been, you know, anticipating that they're going to have surgery, to suddenly find out that it needs to be postponed. But I would have to say that because of the way that our staff have explained it to them, that it was actually about safeguarding them, that, you know, most people have been able to accept it with grace and equanimity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would have to say that for the cancer operations, I've just recently audited, and the average delay is somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks. So it's not like a huge amount of time, although I understand the anxiety that 2 to 4 weeks can be considerable. Yeah.
April, you mentioned that earlier on that initially it was quite stressful. Then everything settled down. Obviously, most of the plans that to overcome this challenge has been in place. How's the situation now? And Xiaowei highlighted some studies showing that it will take 11 months to clear the backlogs. What's your opinion about that?
So the study that you're referring to is the BJS study. And I have to qualify here that it's a modeling study. Modeling studies are important for planning, okay? But it doesn't mean that they are the absolute truth, because they're just projections. And so what you project depends on what information you have at that point in time, okay? So this particular study was projecting that, you know, at the peak of the pandemic, you know, what was the proportion of cancellations that was happening? And then they projected if this continued for 12 weeks, what would be the number? Okay, so that's how they came up with such a huge number. And I think the total, the global cancellation rate was quoted as something like 28 million or something like that, right?
That's right.
But the situation on the ground here in Malaysia is not quite as bad, because firstly, you know, we had these different categories of hospitals. So the complete stop in elective surgeries happened in certain hospitals, but not in others. So at any one time, there was some electives being done, maybe not the category threes, but certainly the category ones were being done. Okay. And on top of that, even those hospitals that had to either stop or to down scale their surgical services, it's not as if we just left the patients hanging in the wind. We actually organized for them to be seen elsewhere, to have their treatment elsewhere. And then on top of that, you know, Malaysia has managed to flatten its curve reasonably rapidly, right? So because of that, our hospital resources have not been overwhelmed, and it's meant that we've been able to restart elective operations much earlier than anticipated. So it doesn't look like it's been that whole 12 weeks of complete cessation. Mm. There's maybe been about 2 weeks or 3 weeks of really hard lockdown on surgeries, but then gradually it's been reinstated, although not quite back to normal volumes, but, you know, it's not been as bad as was projected.
So how far off the mark is that projection, and what is the reality? Can we put a number to it at all?
It's a little bit difficult, because the healthcare landscape in Malaysia is quite complex, as you know. We've got public hospitals, we've got private hospitals, and even public hospitals, you've got Ministry of Health, you've got teaching hospitals, and then you've got now this further dichotomy of being COVID or non-COVID, or even with COVID, it's hybrid or non-hybrid. You know, so it's quite difficult at the moment. I'm sure when everything shakes down, we'll be able to get those numbers, but at the moment, it's quite difficult to give you a specific number. What I can say is that certainly in my department, as mentioned before, the cancer delay, it's around 2 to 4 weeks over what was baseline. But for non-cancer, you know, elective operations, that it's more like 3 to 6 months over baseline. So it's quite different.
What is the impact of delaying cancer surgeries for 2 to 4 weeks? That I guess in relative terms, that doesn't sound like very much.
So again, it's quite difficult to generalize, because it depends on the individual case. And if somebody with a cancer presented with an acute problem, you know, they wouldn't be delayed. Obviously, they would get their surgeries. In general, though, 2 to 4 weeks of delay for a cancer should not lead to a detrimental outcome. Mm. Okay, it's generally most, and again, this is with all sorts of caveats, right? But in general, you can probably delay a cancer operation from anywhere between 1 to 3 months. But obviously, that's a huge generalization, and I would have to say that you need to individualize it to a particular patient.
Mm. And you mentioned that for patients where their elective surgeries could not be handled in, let's say if it was your hospital specifically, you were able to send them elsewhere. Where were they sent to?
So we establish various networks, and it would depend on the specific expertise that's needed. But yes, we had decanting occurring in other university hospitals, but also to some Ministry of Health hospitals and even some private hospitals. But this was done in a very intentional and planned manner. So we had identified people that we could communicate with in those centers, and this was even at hospital director level. You know, there were these agreements that were established. So there wasn't that much delay in terms of getting the patients across for their continued care.
George, you're in a private hospital. Did you have surgeries decanted to your practice?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, obviously for urology, we deal with a range of simple procedure ranging from circumcision to a very complex operation such as a removal of prostate due to cancer. And sometimes, even though it is, you know, simple things like a circumcision, however, if the child is suffering from repeated infection, that needed to be done earlier. So I think one thing that was good was that within hospital, we have a system where we discuss the case and then trying to weigh out the pros and cons, the risk, for example, for a child coming to hospital to undergo a simple operation like circumcision if the child is having huge amount of problems such as recurrent infection, and then but yet trying to use all the protection that we can in order to do that. Now, I think, thankfully, a lot of the, how the ministry had handled the situation and also how we appear not to be as badly affected like countries such as Italy and also UK. And I think we have managed to basically play catch up, and a lot of patients also develop that confidence of returning to hospital and not having the fear of contracting COVID disease in my practice.
I want to ask you to hold on to that thought, George, and Prof. April as well, because on the flip side of patients having their surgeries postponed is, how do we reassure patients that when it's necessary for them to come to the hospital, that their safety and health will be taken care of when it comes to COVID transmission? So we'll catch up on that point after this next break. I'm speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons, Academy of Medicine of Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. On the line with me are Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons, Academy of Medicine of Malaysia. We're discussing what happens to surgeries that were cancelled or postponed due to COVID-19. And as Professor April has explained, there was a study which I quoted from earlier, which was published in the British Journal of Surgery. It was a modelling study which projected that if services in Malaysian hospitals are fully disrupted for 12 weeks, we would be looking at a backlog of more than 150,000 surgeries being cancelled, and that would take about 11 months to clear. But fortunately, in Malaysia, because there was just a modelling study, the reality is much more positive. We haven't been seeing that kind of disruption to services. And correct me if I'm wrong, Prof. April, is visit for UMMC specifically, where we were really only looking at maybe 2 to 3 weeks of a hard lockdown that affected elective surgeries, would you say that's sort of across the board the average for public hospitals?
No. As I mentioned earlier, you know, it really depends on what category of hospital you've been designated to be. So in non-COVID hospitals, it would be different. In COVID hospitals, it's different. And in COVID hybrid hospitals, which is what we are, it's different again. So I wouldn't be able to generalize that to the whole country. But it just gives you an idea of, you know, that things are not quite as gloomy as predicted by the paper.
Yep. If we just go along this thread of projections just for a little bit, if we can just briefly look at if in a situation, perhaps not in our country, in other countries, they're definitely seeing this kind of disruption. When huge amounts of elective surgeries are postponed for a longer period of time, what kind of impact are we talking about, on their treatment outcomes as well down the road?
Yeah, certainly if this goes on for a protracted period and if patients are deferred for longer than what would be considered safe, you can imagine that they may start developing complications and may end up needing surgery, but now under emergency situations rather than under a planned elective situation. And we know that the outcomes for emergency operations are not as good as for elective surgery. So there is that. It is likely that it will require more resources if you're performing the surgery as an emergency, and that will add to costs. And I think that's why the paper had projected the increased costs as a result of having to deal with these complications as a result of deferment. Okay, the psychosocial aspects of deferment. You know,
yeah. Indeed. I mean, you mentioned costs. I'm interested to find out two things. Number one is that how is UM preparing for potential second wave? Are we doing anything potentially different now we've been through, our initial lockdown and also the cancellations of elective operation? And now we're slowly resuming that service. And then, how are we? How do you think, are you in anticipation of second wave?
Well, when we drafted our policies and workflows, we made sure that we embedded this kind of scalable quality to it. And so it allows us to ramp up as well as ramp down depending on what the current situation is. So at the moment, we are quite comfortable. In fact, we've been able to consolidate the wards that were managing COVID patients. But at the same time, we still have that capacity to re-expand if the need arises. So I think at the moment we have that comfort level, even with respect to issues like sufficient PPEs. You know, our procurement team has done a great job of sourcing these items. So I think we're in a good place to deal. Hopefully it doesn't happen, but we are in a good place to deal with subsequent waves if they happen.
But as you said, George, with things easing up and you are ready to welcome patients back for the elective surgeries. But on the flip side, are you seeing patients who are very anxious about potential risk of COVID-19 transmission? And perhaps both of you can walk me through how you talk to a patient to reassure them and what steps would be taken to protect them.
On my side, I think it's a very different world from 4 months ago. For change, every single operation in my hospital, the patient have to undergo a COVID test to prove that they're negative before we put the patient forward for any form of operation. If this was an emergency operation, a full protective PPE it's used in order to protect the healthcare provider. And I think in the future, that sort of mentality, it will continue. And I really think that will obviously add another layer of protection for both parties, for both the healthcare providers and patient, and that will build confidence for patient to come forward for future treatment. However, sadly, obviously with extra caution, that will come with extra cost. And therefore, patients are also aware such measures will incur higher costs. And that's my only concern, even though we are playing extra safe for the better healthcare provision. However, that cost issue is something that is lingering in the air.
Is it significant?
Well, I mean, the COVID test is not cheap, especially if the PCR test. And then also for a full PPE and additional precaution in order to make sure that patient is segregated, and all these require single room and they require excess amount of disposable, I think it is significant.
What about on your side, Prof. April?
Oh, it's very similar. I mean, we have designated zones for patients that we feel or that present with any sort of respiratory symptoms or with any risk of exposure. So we've got designated zones for that. I think if you drive past Jalan University, you will see those tents.
Tents, yes.
Outside. Yeah. So that's our primary screening. When we talk about screening, what George is referring to is the test, but there is a first step before that, which is the risk assessment. And so that is done routinely for all patients coming in so that we can ascertain if they are at risk for having exposure. And then they are dealt with a certain way. In our hospital now, we even have an app through which patients or visitors will enter, will answer a questionnaire which ascertains their risk. And so that's now mandatory. If you want to enter UMMC, you actually have to show that you've done that assessment. Mm-hmm. So a lot of precautions. Everyone has to wear a mask in clinical areas, and that includes patients and their accompanying person. So, there are increased costs. But I think to reassure patients that it's safe to come to hospital, the number of in-hospital transmissions is actually quite low. Most of the patients that we have with COVID have acquired it in the community. It's actually not been in-hospital transmissions. So I think whatever precautions we are taking, it's working. And between healthcare workers to healthcare workers, transmission is extremely low. And I think in terms of even if you did contract the disease and you came to hospital, the recovery rate is high. It's much higher than in many countries in Europe. So I think, if you have a condition that needs to be treated urgently, don't stay away from the hospital because you're worried about transmission. The processes are in place and will keep you safe.
Mm. And you have provided such an optimistic outlook, actually. And I'm particularly impressed at, how you mentioned that there was a planned medical response way in advance, contingency plans in place so that, the moment that the MCO kicked in, your capacity, you were prepared. So, knowing that COVID is going to be around, for the next year, maybe more, is there anything more that needs to be done to further strengthen the surgical capacity in our health system?
I think it's going to be going back to, the gaps and the deficits that we had before. We struggle, certainly in the public healthcare system, we struggle with certain resources. Now, interestingly enough, I know you were asking me about clearing space for surgeries. You know, space is not necessarily the biggest of our problems. We have facilities that could, from a facility point of view, provide surgical care. The issue is going to be things like human resource. You know, but I know that our National Head of Surgical Services has already been working on this as part of the Global Surgery Initiative, and you know, it's quite impressive as how they've actually laid this out. It is just that to implement it takes a little bit more of human resource. So I think it will be possible to accomplish, but it will take a little bit of time.
I'm very sorry, we're running out of time already. Can I get you to share a final message for us today, Prof. April, on this topic of, you know, delaying or cancelling surgeries during this period?
Yeah, so if you need surgery and if it's urgent, rest assured it will be done. Okay? Don't stay away from hospital. Come and see us.
How about you, George?
I think Prof. April highlighted that how well we've done, apart from obviously managing this pandemic and also dealing with all these deferment of elective surgery. However, how many times can we get away with doing so well with stretched resources? I think the only way forward in order to prevent us getting into trouble in the future is investment in healthcare. I really think in the future, whenever we are contemplating, you know, the national budget and that sort of thing, really need to put aside a lot more money for healthcare, because the healthcare is stretched with something like this that hit us. This is just a lesson to learn that we cannot take it for granted.
And that would lead to another big conversation, isn't it, on healthcare financing, which is something we've been trying to reform for the longest time in this country. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, both of you, on the issue of surgeries being affected by COVID-19. I've been speaking to consultant urologist Dr. George Lee, as well as Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, consultant colorectal surgeon and president of the College of Surgeons Academy of Medicine of Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.